from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
1917, the corner of 3rd and Market Streets. Across the street, a giant American flag is unfurled, a signal that the United States has declared war on Germany.
You're listening to a newsreel announcer from the 1930s recalling San Francisco at the brink of World War I, and that is just one of the rare films that archivist Richard Prelinger has unearthed for his Lost Landscapes of San Francisco project. Prelinger is a film archivist and a collector of rare advertising, industrial and amateur and old newsreel and home movie film footage, and he and his wife Megan run a private research library in the South of Market area in San Francisco. We'll talk with them about some of the amazing, what they call ephemeral items they have acquired over the years, and we'll find out what there is to find out about excavations of the past through reels and reels of film footage. Forum is next, after this.
From Nob Hill and South of Market, going off more to a great game than to bloody war. This, then, is San Francisco, 1917.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
San Francisco, renowned throughout the world as the city that knows how.
Well, that was a newsreel clip from the collection of Richard Prelinger, a media archaeologist and collector who calls himself a guerrilla archivist. He's founder of the Prelinger Archive, which was founded in 1983 in New York City, and it grew into a collection of thousands of what he calls ephemeral pieces of film footage from educational, industrial, advertising, and amateur films. The archive was acquired in 2002 by the Library of Congress, and in 2004, Richard Prelinger and his wife, Megan Shaw Prelinger, founded a private research library in South of Market area that features, here in San Francisco, features collections of 50,000 books, periodical volumes, and printed ephemera. The latest project of Richard Prelinger is a trip through San Francisco in the last century called Lost Landscapes, which is made up of home movies, old newsreels, and other film footage. And Richard and Megan Prelinger join us in studio for the second Forum Hour. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. Well, we're going to hear some cuts from this, and I'm excited to have listeners hear some of these cuts because they're exciting to hear. First, I thought we'd talk about the project itself and find out about the library from Megan, who is, well, they're both very involved, but it's kind of become in some ways identified to a greater extent, is it safe to say, with you or not?
Oh, it's truly a joint project.
I thought it was because of the thing about your brain and the taxonomy and all of that, that somehow it had more identity with you. So,
right. Well,
what about, is the rest of this a lost project? I mean, because this stuff started with heavy petting for you, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. That was my beginning. I was working as a typesetter, actually, midnight to 8. Great job at terrible hours. And friends of mine were making a film called Atomic Cafe, which became an extremely successful documentary for the early 80s. And then Norman Lear came to them and said, hey, make me an Atomic Cafe about sex and romance. And I got to quit my typesetting job and be research director. And this was an astonishing world because for the first time I realized how media rich a nation we lived in, but also how much media we throw away. We throw away more media in America than most countries ever produce. And it's in that detritus where you can really kind of latch on to some truths that are absent in more mainstream media like Hollywood films or TV.
Oh, you find out a lot more about American history through some of the stuff that you've come across. And it's overwhelming what you've been able to collect through the years. It's extraordinary. And well, I know when you sold it to the Library of Congress, you kept about 4,000 films, but nevertheless, there was a lot of schlepping involved in this. I mean, a lot of blue-collar kind of toting and loading stuff up.
People think, that archivists wear white gloves and sit and finger valuable documents, and lift a page at a time. But in reality, there's a tremendous amount of very physical work involved. Megan and I are constantly moving books and boxes of ephemera and making runs to L.A. with trucks full of film. Yeah,
you've said that you're interested in this in the predictive sense of this material. What do you mean by that?
Oh, so that's a great question. When you look at the old educational films, let's say from the post-World War II era, which are about training teenagers to behave in very stilted, conventional ways, you think, oh, this is all gone, People are free to be themselves, and, you know, feminism has triumphed to some degree. And you think that these films are kind of antiquated visions of a past that's gone. But it's actually a lot more interesting to think about them as potentially predictive as the pendulum swings or as history permutes in another way. It's perhaps a lot more pertinent to think about some of the things that we don't like in the past as pitfalls that we might need to try to avoid in the future.
Or the immortal words of Mary Tyrone, Eugene O'Neill's character, the past is the present, it's the future too, isn't it?
Well,
that's sort of what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, well, she said it more eloquently, but she took 3 hours to say it, I guess.
One of his longer plays, you're right. The Lost Landscapes film that you've done, which, by the way, will be appearing this Saturday, May 16th at 2 p.m. at the Exploratorium, Lost Landscapes of San Francisco. It opens up, feels like you're entering into a time capsule. At least that was the feeling I had. You're at San Francisco Airport. It's 1941, and you see these big signs that talk about how long it's going to take to get to Los Angeles and New York, and what is it, 14 hours to New York?
Yeah.
I mean, it's as if you're walking back in time, because you are. It's sort of like reality TV brought into the present or something along those lines.
Well, you know, the thing about so first off, I should say San Francisco, we are a tremendously historically conscious city. Maybe that's why we have such a hard time building anything. But there's a tremendous interest in local history. And this started out as just actually a pretty informal project to show some clips at a community place in San Francisco called Counterpulse 3 years ago. And this is the third year, and it's gotten to be somewhat bigger over time. And it's an assembly of especially home movies and amateur footage and some newsreels and a little bit of industrial film. And it goes around the city kind of in a neighborhood by neighborhood trajectory. But the point is to present this footage, most of which is silent, by the way, and let the audience complete it.
It's call and response.
It's totally call and response. And I have to say, it's really wonderful when you get European Americans to talk back to the movie screen. People are extremely, there's a lot of noise out there.
You look like you're about to enter into this conversation, Megan. You have something to add here about this bastard genre that we're talking about? By the way, I'm sorry, does that terminology bother you when it's called a bastard genre?
No.
We celebrate it.
No, we both question conventional notions of, you know, historical legitimacy. So that language plays into that retheorization of the present is significant. The past is significant to the present.
A lot of it's nostalgia, though, isn't it, too?
Mm-hmm.
Which is not necessarily a bad word, but
no, I don't think we're nostalgists, really.
You know, there's something about, you know, I maybe even be a little more polemical. I love the idea of history as an intervention to help us understand what's happening currently, to use historical material and push it back into the culture in such a way that people have to ask harder questions. So it is, you know, of course, I mean, we celebrate the San Francisco that was because it's got a great history and it looks great in Kodachrome and it's exciting to see a familiar landmark. But it's also interesting to think about how we can, you know, change the present and the future by understanding the past.
Well, here's an example of this audio of Lost Landscapes that we're talking about. Here's a 1937 San Francisco campaign advertisement. It's for a newsreel, and it's for a $49 million subway bond measure, and this is not related to next week's special election, so give a listen.
But now, do we San Franciscans really know how to do things for ourselves? Just look at these typical scenes in traffic. Do we know how to solve our own traffic problems? Four tracks on Market Street, and those archaic Market Street Railway one-man streetcars. Strap hanging, slow cars, late cold dinners and 2 cent transfers. Uh-oh, just like squeezing sardines into a can. No room for this chap. His 7 cents was no good. I will never forget the first time I got caught on that four-track no-man's land. It is terrifying. Let's end this menace to life and limb. And, believe it or not, Mr. Ripley, Market Street handles a larger volume of surface traffic than any street in the world. If San Francisco knows how, then go to the polls November 2nd and vote yes for Proposition Number 1.
Well, that was a campaign ad for a 1937 subway ballot measure, which failed. Where'd you come across this?
This is a film that came from a collector named Bert Gould, who was a Worked in film preservation at a lab. He was also a music scholar and one of the unknown early founders of Pacifica, by the way. But he also collected Bay Area historical material and preserved it from the nitrate. And this was one of his. We acquired his collection back in the 90s.
You've also got in Lost Landscapes some promotional material of the building of the Bay Bridge. Where'd you come by that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so there were a lot of – it was extremely photogenic, you know, and you imagine these – you'll see at the show the towers that where the roadway isn't built and the cables are hanging from these almost empty towers. A lot of footage was shot, and the most hair-raising film we have is called Bridging San Francisco Bay, which was made by U.S. Steel, the steel supplier for the bridge, and it's frightening film showing these men running around and, you know, with almost no safety harnesses. And of course, some of them did fall into the drink.
Well, here's another cut I wanted listeners to hear. It's from a 1930s newsreel, and they're talking about Armistice Day, 1918. Mm-hmm. And note, if you will, the reference to talk about the past and the present, influenza masks.
Now, San Francisco, 1918, 21 years ago this week. The armistice is signed. The war is over. Into Market Street for the men and women of the city to celebrate. Up and down the street they parade, delirious with joy. For some of them have come to know the meaning of war. Grotesque and ugly in their influenza masks, the people of San Francisco celebrate. You've seen the signs they carry. Kaiser Wilhelm is Sweet William now. Who's afraid of the Huns? Some of them signs of hate, most of them just outpourings of a great joy. For this day, November 11th, 1918, marks the end of an era of hate and bloodshed and violence. It's the beginning of peace and goodwill on Earth. And those who have died have not died in vain. They've died to make the world safe for democracy. They've swept to victory in the war to end war. And so San Francisco celebrates in 1918 because the war is over and there'll never be another.
Whoa, there's a chilling conclusion to that. By the way, if you want to see the video from that newsreel, you can simply find a link at kqed.org/forum. Where'd you come by that?
Boy, I think that came from an old a cameraman named Frank Vail, who I met him when he was 99 years old. He was quite hale and hearty, and he made ginger cookies with applesauce instead of sugar at age 99. And he had shot that himself. He was at the time about, you know, 25 years old, and it was in his collection.
You should mention that you've had about 30 million downloads on the Internet Archives that
yes.
You have. And Megan, how does the library complement the Internet site? What's the interaction between the two, really?
Well, the library...
Because I know you don't have a computer.
Oh, no, we're a hybrid analog-digital library, and we have over 3,700 digital books. Part of the project of the library is to kind of collapse the working distinction or
between analog and digital.
Between analog and digital, yeah, and experiment with how they can interoperate with one another and how a collection of books can be kind of animated, both as a digital collection to serve one kind of audience in one kind of way and as a working walk-in installation of analog, very kind of
physical,
stimulating objects where people can be involved with the smell, touch, and feel of old books and, really excite a walk-in audience at the same time.
But it's not one of those libraries where you walk in and you go over to the computers and, you know, find yourself at least availability of computers. This is a place where analog and digital simply work almost symbiotically.
That's the idea, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you raise an interesting point. When you go into many libraries, that's the first thing you see is the computer screen with a blinking cursor. Type in what you want. And, you know, we think that that's great, but it's also reductive. And it's hard to browse a search engine. It's hard to browse a database.
It's also hard to just come across something you weren't looking for.
That's right.
Well, you guys are all about browsing, really.
We are.
We're serendipity people, and that's most of our work, you know, is based on things we found. We've both done, you know, significant projects that come out of trolling the library to see what's there. And we'd love other people to have that experience. You know, private libraries aren't all about wealthy people locking books up and
you see a future for non-digital libraries?
Absolutely. For one thing, a lot of young people in the kind of born digital era when they get to encounter a book artifact that has historical density to it and they get to touch it and feel it, they get excited about it as an artifact in ways that people who grew up among a lot of books don't always get. And we see some of the groups from which it's hardest to extract them out of the library are really young adults.
The kids have to be dragged out, literally.
Dragged out.
You know, who would have thunk it? And maybe it's because books are privileged objects, but there's something about actually being able to go up to a shelf, find something and be surprised that we don't think it's anachronistic. You know, you read about colleges, universities closing libraries down and building bookless buildings. And I actually think that institutions like University of Chicago, where they're still keeping all the physical books on campus, that's going to be a draw.
Well, in fact, Dan Goldman was on during this 10 o'clock hour yesterday, the guy who wrote Emotional Intelligence,
sure.
new book, Ecological Intelligence. And he was saying, well, she said, I hope books don't disappear. And I said, I quoted Umberto Eco, who actually I quoted in my book as saying, you know, they thought that painting would disappear when photography was invented. It's just, it's almost analogous.
Yeah, it's a problem when new media are introduced, that legacy media experience a period of feeling threatened. And they're positioned in the culture for a while as being threatened. And then the culture moves on and absorbs the contemporary and the historical and, you know, makes a new future out of both of them.
Let me say that you have some documents here that you've, like the Bureau of Indian Affairs, I know you've alluded to, because you've got stories in there of whites dressing up like Indians and raiding other white people to make it seem like the raid was carried out by Indians. Then you've got U.S. Immigration Service back in U.S. Immigration Commission back in 1911, for example, reports about doing phrenology on different races and ethnic groups in order to determine who should be coming into this country. I mean, this is just from a historical standpoint, to have those materials in your hands, it's fascinating stuff.
The materials you mentioned are also online, too, so that people who are far away can download them and work with them in any way they please.
How can they access you online? You want to just let them know?
Well, we have our website is prelingerlibrary.org, and there's a link
That's
there.
P-R-E-L-I-N-G-E-R, Prelinger. Yeah.
Correct. And our digital books collection is hosted by the Internet Archive, just as the film collection is. And there's a link there to the digital books collection.
And you see the library as a kind of a workshop for people to just come together, congregate, yeah?
Absolutely. We're really interested in taking what could have been a passive repository of books, would in other contexts have been formulated as a passive repository, and turning it into something that's a community space, turning it into a place where the transaction between visitor and book is foregrounded. Stepping away from query-based access, as we discussed, and really foregrounding the browsing experience, which then also becomes a social experience, not just between people and resources, but also between people and each other.
The life-changing thing about actually really both the Moving Image Archives and the library has been, you know, our discovery. And we didn't really know this beforehand, that when you put resources directly into people's hands, that really interesting and unpredictable things can happen. And that's really what it's been for us.
We're talking to the Prelingers, Richard Prelinger and Megan Shaw Prelinger. And by the way, we welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to join us, please feel free to do that. You can do it whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius XM satellite. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, feel free to join the conversation. Toll-free 866-733-6786, or simply send an email to forum@kqed.org. Let's talk a little bit more about Lost Landscapes, because that's going to be shown again at the Exploratorium on Saturday, May 16th at 2 o'clock, Lost Landscapes of San Francisco, and some of the footage that you managed to get for this.
So one of the things that really in the last few years the archives has moved in the direction of collecting home movies and amateur film. And home movies are kind of special, you know, for so often for such a long time they were commonplace and people largely ignored them. But they're interesting. They're personal expression. They're not corporate expression. They're, you know, that there's a person behind the camera deciding what to shoot. And quite often they're records of things and places and activities you don't find anywhere else. So we've been really actively collecting home movies, especially of San Francisco. And, you know, you see family life in the avenues. You see the touristic footage. You see people who are so thrilled with the plane ride in that they, you know, they had the camera going as they landed at SFO in 1941. And I tend to think that that's going to be our direction. Now, that's what most of the Lost Landscape show is. It's unseen home movie footage.
But you've also got this footage, you know, this amazing footage of people, for example. Well, you were alluding to it earlier, like teenage stuff, you know, mental health in teenagers and the angry boy and, you know, what to do about the angry boy and all these kinds of things that just...
Angry Boys at once, the only film where, you know, somebody shoots their shrink in the head with a suction cup gun.
Yes. We got a caller. Let's go to our calls. In fact, Ryan from Iowa is our first caller. Where are you in Iowa, Ryan?
I'm just south of Des Moines, a small town called Lacona, Iowa.
I'm glad to have you.
Thank you. I was interested if you had come across any anti-civil rights propaganda media that would perhaps mirror some of the anti-gay media we're seeing these days, including things similar to the National Organization for Marriage, or I can't remember, but saying how giving blacks equal rights would somehow be taking away the rights of whites, or anything similar to that.
We don't have much, if any, of that, but there was a bunch produced. A bunch of it's at the Mississippi State Archives, the Citizens Councils of America that used to be called the White Citizens Council.
Ku Klux Klan, basically.
Yeah, they were the front, the respectable so-called front of the KKK. They were very active media producers in the late 50s and early 60s, and I think Mississippi is going to put their stuff online. I'll also say parenthetically that just a month ago we discovered rather shocking footage shot in a suburb of Reading, Pennsylvania, but it's a KKK march from 1936. And, you know, that's really a nationwide phenomenon.
Well, I saw also some footage you had about gangs. And, you know, it's funny to see these guys who are portrayed as juvenile delinquents, you know, the way they look compared to what you'd see a gang member looking like in today's urban world. Let me get to another caller. Michelle, join us. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been to the Prelinger Library, and I found it to be one of the most fascinating libraries I've ever been to. What they're referring to as their serendipity search is absolutely fantastic. It just leaves your brain open, explore, and check out everything that's available.
Talk about serendipity search, and thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. You want to talk about?
Well, that's part of what we were really trying to weave with the library, is an environment where, in having an alternative taxonomic structure, an alternative to Dewey Decimal, an alternative to Library of Congress, to create an environment where the subjects flow into one another and create series of juxtapositions that don't exist elsewhere and that are concrete expressions of kinds of sets of ideas that we've had, or thoughts about projects that we've had or projects we've actually done, but also that form a kind of a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts, and that enables others to get lost and to find things that they wouldn't otherwise come across.
And, you know, an interesting thing about that is that I think there's authorship in the way that a library is arranged and organized. It isn't a mechanical. It isn't an algorithm. It isn't, a database. But the categories and the way that the clusters interact is actually a work of authorship, I think.
Well, we're talking about authorship. We're talking about libraries. We're talking about some rare film footage from advertising and industrial world and promotion and amateur filmmaking that has made up this extraordinary world that the Prelingers live in. And you can join us. In fact, our toll-free number again is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum at kqed.org. And when we return, we'll hear more from you. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Richard Prelinger. You prefer Rick?
Rick is fine, yeah.
And Megan Shaw Prelinger, and co-founders and architects of information design of the Prelinger Library, which is a collection of 40,000 books, periodicals, printed ephemera, and government documents located south of Market in San Francisco at 8th and Folsom. They're also responsible for Lost Landscapes of San Francisco, which will be appearing this Saturday, May 16th at 2 p.m. at the Exploratorium. And Rick Prelinger has been collecting rare advertising, industrial, and amateur films for over 25 years. Latest project, again, is Lost Landscapes of San Francisco. You are welcome to join the program. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to us at our email address, which is forum@kqed.org. Going to be maybe too much material in the future for the kind of efforts that you're doing?
That's a great question. It isn't going to be possible to collect all the media, all the email, all the audio that people are making. And archivists, to a great extent, you know, aren't going to be people anymore. A lot of this is going to have to be handled by machines, and we'll collect a lot more than we can ever see or look through or deal with. But at the moment, we are primarily working with physical materials and just trying to build a context to let those physical materials kind of sing, you know.
And your point speaks to the idea of the collector as author, that collection building we see as something that's going to happen in the future where individuals and groups will build collections that are specific to topics and places that will be carry collecting into the future and in an act of curatorship of the kind of plethora of print and multimedia that's becoming available.
A lot of my colleagues in the archival field would disagree with this, but I don't believe that it's a core value that we need to try to save everything. I mean, history is about desire. And to a great extent, that desire is what we don't know, we can't see, we can't find. And a lot of the new and emerging histories that we've seen develop in the last few years have been, you know, motivated by a lack of obvious record. And so those gaps are going to be formative as well as vexing.
I just want to give listeners, again, an idea of some of this footage. And I was saying off air that it reminds me of some of the work the Kitchen Sisters have done with audio, just collecting, you know, all of these audios that all too often were thrown away or were part of flea market sales or all of that sort of thing. But, you know, there's some things on here that are just really like this. Back in the 1940s, there were a couple that undergo hypnosis. By the name of Claire and Don, or there's a Hormel processing plant where you find out what happens when pigs are slaughtered. I mean, these are just kind of arcane little, I call them tranche de vie, slices of life that really represent the past and give us a portal to the past.
I mean, they not only represent aspects of the past that we may not know much about or may not remember, but they also represent the persuasions of the past. Because they're normative. They're about the way we were supposed to behave, the way that we were, you know, good consumer, good student, good citizen, you name it.
Good wife and mother and all of that sort of thing. Good husband, good child, all of those values that have gone through some serious kinds of liberation, shall we say.
Which is not to say that you can trust what you see in these films, because remember, these were typically top-down pictures of how people were supposed to behave. But, you know, if you're interested about what, you know, goes into your stomach, go online and download This Is Hormel, which you were just referring to, Michael. It's about two farm boys from Minnesota get a tour through the Hormel factory in Austin, Minnesota, and they see almost all aspects of meat being made. And it's actually great. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking, but it's a bit hair-raising as well.
Is there a gem, you know, something of particular value and importance to you that you crown jewel or whatever of your collection?
I'll mention one, and then I think Megan might mention her recent favorite as well. I like this film, Master Hands, which was actually the first industrial film to get put on the National Registry. And real quickly, it's a film about making Chevys in Flint in 1937. But it's 36, but it's an industrial symphony that kind of ennobles the workers that are making these cars. But at the same time, it has this internal contradictory thing because it shows how dangerous, how boring, how repetitive, the work is to make these cars. And it's kind of a genuine classic of what I call capitalist realism. It uses the value, you know, the style of socialist realism to promote free enterprise.
And recently we've acquired a collection from the Systems Development Corporation that is a collection from the 1950s and early 1960s depicting the company's kind of normalization of early electronics into their corporate culture and explaining how early electronics with graphic representations are going to carry industry into the future, including animations of early data networks that were precursors to the internet, and early kind of worker training films that showed both African-American workers and women workers engaging in
as geeks,
in electronics development, and actually showing them doing programming work in the 1950s, and then with cuts to animated sequences of computational networks being described.
Well, there's a kind of whole industrial firm brainwashing genre. I mean, maybe talk about why they were made and where they were shown. And Rick, do we have a modern equivalent to that?
We do, except what happens now is that so much media is being made on video and online that we don't notice it. It doesn't break, you know, through the threshold for most of us. But two kinds of films made in-house, you know, for training or for indoctrination, you know, and then films made to tell the story of a corporation out to the public, what we call institutional advertising. These days, that would be an op-ed or it would be a website, you know, something of that sort. But, you know, artists made these films. We have some Monsanto films about chemistry from the 50s, and these were made by people who also had careers.
I saw some names that I recognized.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Alexander Hammett and Willard Van Dyke and Maya Darren and all these, you know, cool people made industrials.
The Eameses.
The Eameses, of course.
It's a whole extra income for them, I'm sure. Martin, good morning. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to talk to you all. I have enjoyed using the Prillinger archives as a teaching tool in my classes, and I really want to thank you guys for that. I am a book collector, an industrial archaeologist, and wondering at 50 what I should do with my collection. And I have similar friends who have collected these kind of books. And I just know because of all the prints, the absolute beauty of these plates, they'll never be created again. And just, you know, what can I do with them? What's going to happen?
Well, what comes to my mind fleetingly is tax deduction contribution, right?
How about a wing at the Prillinger Archives? I think we could work that out.
We'd love to talk.
The Martin wing.
Yeah, we'd love to talk for sure. We do collect a lot in that area. We would try to make sure to feed it into the digital books realm somehow if it was available to be digitized.
You know, it's what you raise, Martin, a really interesting question because, yes, we love to collect and we try to grow within limits. We can't collect everything. We're not trying to be Nicholson Baker or the, you know, set up a clone of the Library of Congress. But we're in a situation where there's going to be a lot of books that have no homes. If the big Google Book Project goes forward, there will be hundreds of millions of books that small colleges get rid of. And it's going to be a cultural crisis of sorts.
In fact, you remind me of when Nick Baker was on here making his fervent plea, you know, stop burning the books. Sounds like something out of Ray Bradbury. But, you know, there was a sense that the library, as it was moving more toward the digital age and more into the new technology, was just simply burning the books, literally.
But we're also interested in modeling the ease with which a person can open a small independent collection and offer it to the public. We are one of a whole wide number of loosely connected independent research libraries across North America, some of which are as small as only 200 or 300 volumes, and they may be installed those volumes in a corner of a gallery or a eating establishment, and it's a functioning working library. It doesn't have to be of the scale of our operation to be a functioning working independent library.
The barrier to entry is low. Anybody can do this. We were in a bar in Beatty, Nevada last week, and there was a library there.
Yep. Do you guys know when you were growing up, did you want to be archivists, even in your skull?
No. More of an organic expression of years and years of just investigation and exploration. And kind of finding that truth lay in between the layers of history that were underexplored and, you know, developing habits. We both developed independently of doing projects based on evidence that we'd found in unusual places.
Well, here's a listener who says, it seems the Prillinger Library blurs the line between museum and library. Can you guys suggest what museum changes they would like to see?
Oh, you know, museum, yeah, that's an interesting. We often think of the library as an installation. And in fact, Megan has arranged the books such that there's like sort of spatial rhyming between different components of the library. And when you walk through a collection and, you know, the metadata, as librarians say, is the same as the data.
Yeah, I was informed as a taxonomy designer of the library, you know, by a history of work in installation art and using documents as artifacts in installations.
It's a work of art.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, let me go to some more emails here.
Thanks.
There's a listener named Sally who says, I read an interesting article about the Preilinger's Library a couple of years ago. I think it was in the New Yorker. Actually, that's probably the Harper's article.
Harper's piece, yeah.
Could your guest share with the audience more about their filing system? It sounded interesting, as though it encouraged visitors to browse. Well, of course, as we said, it is very browsable. It's what browsing is all about. But you just alluded to the rhyming and talk more about the filing. Yeah.
Well, we wanted to have the collection express its contents kind of indigenously. Like the collection is formed of our interests in landscape, media, and social and political history and space history, and it made sense. So how do those subjects naturally fit together as an expression of kind of the insides of our minds? And that was alluded to in that article. And that's really, since we met and started converging our collections around landscape and land use history, it made sense to have that taxonomy be landscape-based. So that's how it is. It starts as a walk through the landscape of ideas, starting in San Francisco, and then wends itself associatively and, I think, pretty sensibly.
The two biggest words for the Preilingers, landscape and ephemeral.
Yeah.
They kind of epitomize a lot of it. Actually, somebody named Mark in Berkeley says, I'd like to ask the Preilingers a question. I found Lost Landscapes on Amazon, and they say it is a DVD-R manufactured on demand. Is this the best way to obtain this product, or is there a different incarnation that the Preilingers offer for sale?
If somebody found it on Amazon, it's dare I say, it's an unauthorized reproduction. We've only given it to friends. It's made to be something that's performed live. I haven't made a DVD out of it.
Should look into that, Rick. Here's Sean, who says, I'd like to hear what your guests know about the famous film Last Night of the Barbary Coast. When were the prints seen? Any chance others will be found?
Oh, I don't know about
that. Know.
We'll write it down.
Don't know.
Well,
somebody
Sorry.
Will know, and somebody can email us if they do. Paul writes, I inherited a photo book of the day after the San Francisco earthquake. Lots of rubble, well annotated, with addresses and cross streets, etc. It's quite large, but not well preserved or maintained. We'd like to sell it or possibly donate it. What do you advise we do to start?
Well, you should talk to a librarian or a book dealer and find out if it's an uncommon book and, you know, whether it can be repaired as well.
And Joe from Oakland says, this is a fascinating program, wonderful project. There's always a problem with any window into the past, though. It can become a good platform for reinforcing our own present-day smugness. It's all too easy to look at all of the old media and sneer at how naive, narrow-minded, or unsophisticated the producers and consumers of that media may have been. At best, a study of old media should lead to some form of empathy and the ability to understand the narratives and images and the terms that they were understood at the time. Sadly, this almost never seems to happen. Inevitably, someone uses images and narratives from old media to launch into a showcasing of their own enlightened attitudes.
I think Joe's right. We tend to eternalize the present. We think we know everything, and we think that it's always going to be that way. I mean, just the last 3 months, everybody talks about how Twitter is changing the world all by itself and how the Kindle is changing the world all by itself. These are just two little moments in tremendous, huge, long processes.
But at the same time, we see collecting documents in the library as an act of intervention into trends in historical memory, and collecting things that people would not have otherwise remembered and kind of disrupting that type of pattern.
Well, it's also curious to see, without feeling smug, as the caller suggests, the listener suggests, for example, you go to a movie like Revolutionary Road and they try to recreate the 50s and everybody's wearing a hat. You look at San Francisco in the 50s and all the men are wearing hats and so forth, a lot of the women too, of course. And it just seems kind of quaint almost. It's just historically sort of interesting as a visual or as an image, as opposed to thinking, well, we don't wear hats now and, you know, we look different and we are different because, of course, that's the case. Lorraine from Santa Rosa says, I missed the name of the footage that Rick mentioned about making of a Chevy in 1936. Could you repeat that?
Master Hands. It's a free download at archive.org.
And Omar says, I joined late, but I wonder, are you planning to put some of the films online on YouTube, for example, or extend your taxonomy to online materials?
We have over 2,000 films online for free, no restrictions at the Internet Archive. And as Megan mentioned, we have 3,700 books. So get crazy.
And the digital books collection is in the process of having an online interface that is taxonomized.
Krista, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is fascinating. You were speaking earlier about industrial hygiene films, and I really, really resonate with what your listener earlier said about how we become very smug when we look back at these things. I had a chance to see a number of those industrial hygiene films when I was a senior in college. I was working in what was then called the AV department, and there were dozens and dozens of reels of film that were cataloged. So I had a chance to watch some of those. They were frightening in the message of conformity. It seemed almost to be a similar tone to what we saw in the propaganda films about communism.
It wasn't only industrial hygiene or communism films. You just set off a memory chord in my head, Krista. When I was in high school, we had a course called hygiene, and they would show movies. I don't know if you came across any of these, Megan and Rick, but they would show movies about lung cancer and how they were graphic as hell, and kids would deposit their cigarettes into a bag that the hygiene teacher would hold as you left. It was designed to scare. And there were films, of course, about VD, as it was called at the time, social diseases or sexually transmitted diseases that also were designed, like those army films, to scare the hell out of you.
There's a film about almost any aspect of behavior that you can imagine. Back in the day when there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of 16-millimeter projectors in schools, and there was a market, and there was even a federal subsidy for making these, people made films about everything. You can construct a rather, you know, complete picture of what life was supposed to be like in that period. And Krista, you're right. A lot of it is quite scary. But it's also interesting to think about why it's scary. Why were these messages being put out? Whose interest it was to and so on. I mean, there's a core of truth in these films, too. People should be clean and healthy, I suppose. But, yeah.
Thank you, Krista. On we go to Alameda. Don, join us. You're on the air on Forum.
It's John.
John.
Are you familiar with the videos that were made as a result of Andy Pisano doing some 16-millimeter filming in the 1930s of Neptune Beach, building the Bay Bridge, and the Expo in 1939-40?
I didn't hear the name.
Andy Fagano.
Fagano.
Yeah, you've got a lot on the Bay Bridge, but you don't know
that name. I don't know about Andy Fagano's work. I'd love to know more.
It's available at the Alameda Museum or at Gano's Hardware in Alameda on Lincoln at St. Charles. You can buy the videos, and they have them for sale at the store.
Thanks.
And they're very interesting views into Alameda and Bay Area history.
Well, thank you for that. Appreciate it, John. And, in fact, you can learn a lot about the Bay Bridge and the promotion that was done in the building of the Bay Bridge from the new film, Lost Landscapes of San Francisco. I've got a caller who's calling about wineries. Good morning.
Good morning. My name's Matthew, and I'm looking for some information about urban winemaking in San Francisco. I'm actually establishing a winemaking facility in the South of Market area. I understand there's a rich history of winemaking here in San Francisco.
Megan,
no,
Rick,
we
can
have
you
collection on food history that's of great interest to contemporary food theorists, but not so much on oenology.
Well, this might be of help. Here's an email from Dean who says, in 1909, San Francisco journalist Horatio F. Stoll produced a film featuring the wine districts of California. It was the first film in which the Napa Valley was depicted and shown in theaters. The film portrayed the harvest, crush, and winery operations and was used to promote the early wine industry of any day of the day. You don't know this film?
No. Very little is known about films
probably
from that period. And so
may not exist anymore, in fact.
The odds are poor, but it would be wonderful if it did. I'm writing it down.
Nancy, good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Hello.
Hi.
Nancy.
Yes, Nancy.
Oh,
that's
thank you. Thank you. I appreciate this topic enormously because I find serendipity the joy of living. And through my book hunt of travel and exploration in the 19th century, I have had more enjoyable times than I can possibly say, you know, wandering around old books stores. I have several questions. One, I want to make sure I can preserve what I have as a couple of hundred really fine books that have wonderful illustrations that are not available anyplace else. And I think because the camera came in so late in the 19th century, the woodcuts and the other illustrations are extremely important to preserve. So when we talk about putting things online, I want to make sure that books like mine are part of that recordation and possibly even saving the books as originals because the colorations are such that they're exquisite.
Yeah, Nancy, I'm afraid we don't have time for several questions, but perhaps Rick or...
But I also want to mention that I have glass negatives, and I want to know where glass negatives that are 5x7s can also be preserved.
Okay, we'll talk about preservation. Rick, Megan?
So there's a number of excellent resources online from archival groups and library groups that give really good authoritative information about that. Glass negatives are tough, but there are enclosures, and you can get information online about a good environment. If you shoot us an email, we'll point you to some of those resources.
Well, give your email address.
Well, info@prelingerlibrary.org.
Okay, and you are listening to Forum. We are talking to the Prelingers, Rick Prelinger and Megan Shaw Prelinger, and this is Pledge Week for KQED Public Radio. So for more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we go next to Montana. Karen, where are you in Montana, Karen?
I'm in Missoula.
Well, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I guess I just have a question. I have newspapers from Pearl Harbor, the days correctly after my grandfather was a Pearl Harbor survivor. And I want to know how to preserve them or maybe donate them because they're awesome.
So there,
is that possible?
Well, just to start with, there are archival supplies that can help you protect them from light and dust damage while you're spending some time finding out where best to place them. And,
we could also point you to some resources for that. A lot of people, in all honesty, a lot of people save newspapers around great national events like that. But locally, especially in the city where those papers came from, mm-hmm. those are the kinds of artifacts that can get a lot of people, especially young people, really focused on history and thinking historically. So, you know, if you have a notion at any point to find a public place where they can be displayed, that's kind of a wonderful thing.
It's also good to save kind of the offbeat things, which I don't know. I was in Columbus, Ohio, and there was a headline in the Columbus Dispatch, which was the newspaper, and it said LBJ to attend Winnie Wright's. They had to fit, you know, the number of letters in there. It was Churchill's death. Mm. So Winnie Wright's. And I thought, this is disgraceful, but this is something that has to be saved. I mean, just that kind of oddball thing. Mm-hmm. It's like having a stamp from Guyana that has a kind of inversion on it or something. Mm-hmm. They become almost collector's items just by that. You encourage people to make new works using these films as raw material. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So there's amazing, amazing material in archives all over the world. And unfortunately, it's quite hard to touch. Film is fragile. Sometimes you have to pay a lot of money to get access to it, whatever. It's not in a form you can use. And we made a great many of our films available as digital files, which you can download and then bring into your computer and re-edit. And have a way of knowing this for sure, but some tens of thousands of new works have been made out of our material in kind of every area that you might imagine. And this is the way that archives, we think, are legitimized. You know, archives are... live by use. We exist to be consumed in a way.
And, well, there are filmmakers who come to mind, like Wiseman, for example, who uses real footage a lot. Documentary filmmakers certainly use real footage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and we've worked with a great many of them. You know, Sam Green here in town, yeah. who did The Weather Underground and is now doing a pretty interesting project on Utopia, which I don't think is going to shrink from the ideas that are involved. Michael Moore used heavy use.
Yeah, I wonder what he would have thought of that Chevy movie that you
used it.
Did he? Oh, he did use it.
We gave it to him for Roger and me.
What about just the footage sale business? Have you learned anything that could help the survival of the film or music industries? Just in terms of giving things away?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting question. When we sell stock footage and we charge an arm and a leg for it through Getty Images, you pay if you want a contract, you pay if you want high quality. And when we put all the same stuff up online, our sales doubled. And there is something about this notion of putting your work before the public and then charging for added value that has worked tremendously well for us, and it supports our library as well.
Jeremy from Santa Rosa, our next caller. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the collector if he had a copy of a humorous put-on film called The Spaghetti Harvest.
I've never heard of it.
Sounds great.
It was done in the style of a BBC educational film from the 1950s and 60s. And it shows the people out gathering spaghetti, which is lying on bushes, and drying it in the sun, and then talking at the end about the denouement is always this feast of homegrown spaghetti.
No, would love to see it.
Well, once again, if people have material or they have things that... they want to contribute or donate, simply go to your website.
Yeah.
And a next project after Lost Landscapes?
Well, Megan's really been working heavily on a project.
Based on our Cold War and space history collections, I've just finished a monograph called Another Science Fiction. That's a historical book about the early space race based on the cultural formulation of the space race through recruitment advertising in the 50s and 60s. And I've been working on that. It's really an outgrowth of the library project and will be out early next year.
Well, we'll look forward to that and good luck with it. And you both are involved in pretty fascinating stuff. It's been fun to have you here and certainly been illuminating, and I thank you both. Richard Prelinger, Rick Prelinger, and Megan Shaw Prelinger, and they are in charge of the Prelinger Library. The Lost Landscapes of San Francisco can be seen again this Saturday, May 16th at 2 p.m. at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Tina Larberg, and Amanda Stupai, and our engineer, Danny Bringer, and our interns, Will Duke, Chandra Ganguly, Kylie Gordon, and Sophia Salazar Rubio. Thanks to Diana Kwan, who we have had to send on her way to the big world out there, and we wish good luck. We also want to thank our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Thanks to all of you, our listeners, for all of us at KQED. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.